sense, were able to extract more energy than they put into the test chamber. They kind of played games. It was the amount of energy they put in through the laser. They didn't factor in the incredible inefficiency of the pulse laser. I think it's 1% efficient. So they had to put 100 times the amount of energy that they finally extracted out to do that. So, you know, that kind of fudges the whole damn thing. No one really cares about the amount of laser energy you use to free the same amount of fusion energy if it costs 10 times the amount of energy to get the laser energy. So, you know, it's an interesting experiment. It's another advance, but we're far away from a commercial fusion reactor of any kind.
Okay, I said about the Omega laser that was used. The very first form of Omega laser was the inertial confinement fusion experiment that was done. It was 60 beam ultraviolet frequency tripled neodymium gas laser, which was capable of delivering 40 kilojoules and up to 60 of terawatts, making it one of the most powerful and highest energy laser in the world. The laser light was focused at 1 millimeter in diameter. Some specimen suspended in spherical vacuum chamber 3.3 meters in diameter. 3.3 meters, it's time 3. It's in about 11, 3, 3, 3. Okay, so it would be 9.9, about 10 square feet.
And you'd have to replace a lot of the chamber after every pulse. So this was certainly not going to be a continuous pulse generator of power. You know, and you know, the chamber costs money. It's a very sophisticated design. It's not just a little pipette made out of plastic with some deuterium in it. It's a very sophisticated design.
They actually found that it was $21 million US dollars in 1980. So we say three times of this money today. Still, comparing to the military budget of the United States, it's not much money. Anyhow, I believe that I said everything about that. You can go to the next one. Lucy. We spoke about Lucy. I love Lucy. She was 3.5 feet tall. But we're not talking about Lucy as a Lucy, because she was only 3.2 million years old. We're talking about Neanderthals, 60 million years ago. And Dr. Roy was kind enough to respond to my questions, as I'm due, completely not educated in that area. And I do thank you for that. But there was an additional question that he decided to respond to a few minutes before the TechNet. I didn't expect that. Thank you for that. Anyhow, so human evolution can help, but it is fascinating, the story where we came from. So today we, the Homo sapiens, are the only human species left. But there was many of us, there was many Adams and many of Eve, many of us. And they fight with each other, killing each other, even eating each other. And it happened for millions of years. So you're not saying that the Neanderthal was 60 million years ago. No. He was If I'm not mistaken, present 60 million years. And he died due to Lucy, I believe, the small creature. But anyhow, for millions of years, there was the evolution of human species from small-brained in Indonesia, Asia, the robust Netherlands dominated so much in Eurasia, Eurasia, if I probably pronounce Eurasia, okay? And for hundreds of thousands of years, those species, those Adams and Eves, competed, but they also mix. So as Dr. Wu said, and I found that that's true, everybody of us has 2% of Neanderthal of genes. So there was the Dr. Chris Stringer, Dr. Fred Spencer, Tristan Hughes, and they became known for going deep into it. And then I sent to Dr. Roy the email. Because in that video that I have sent him, the 60 million years Neanderthal, that was fossil, it was fossil. They found DNA. And I remember that we had another gentleman showing his skepticism that DNA could be found. But they found, and it was told in that video, which was true because I checked it in other sources, it was found many times, not one time, many, many times, the DNA from the fossil. So I said something about the dinosaurs, but now I'm talking about the human species. And Dr. Roy gave me a guidance for it. So could you please, Dr. Roy, say about the half-life and the story about the DNA? Dr. Roy.
Okay, there's a couple of things you said that you probably didn't mean to say. You said that the Neanderthals were 60 million years ago. You meant 60,000 years ago. Also, you said something weird about Lucy killed the Neanderthals, or the Neanderthals killed Lucy. I'm not quite sure what you meant by that.
Okay, the Neanderthals started to appear 60 million years ago. They died out 40,000 years ago. The Lucy is 2.9 million old. But actually, many scientists at first thought that she was 3.2 million years old. So it's 2.9 million years old. And the DNA, has a half-life of, I'm not going to take your quote because I would love you to tell me. So in other words, Neanderthals, from 60 million years ago to 40,000 years ago, they were present. And the DNA from Neanderthal was found not one time, but many times. Dr. Roy.
Well, I mean, once again, I disagree with you incredibly. There was nothing like you and me being 60 million years ago. Neanderthals first show up about 430,000 years ago. And the last discoveries are dated around 40,000 years ago. So there's a big difference between Lucy, who's 2 million plus, and dinosaurs, T-Rexes, that are 60 million years plus, and Neanderthals that could be just 40,000 years. The idea is that the DNA, under special occasional circumstances, decays at around a half-life of, say, 500 years. So So the number of base pairs diminish every 500 years, and it's within the realm of possibilities for a 40 or 50,000-year-old Neanderthal that's well-preserved that you can extract enough fragments of DNA, multiple fragments, and kind of try and put it together, and they have. We have a good idea of Denisovian DNA and Neanderthal DNA because they coexisted, you know, 40, 50,000 years ago. In Africa, you're not going to get a lot of Neanderthals. Neanderthals are present in about 2% of our DNA in Europe and Asia. And in a place in the Philippines, there seems to be a high percentage of Denisovian DNA. So it's not that we ate them all up or killed them. Sometimes we had sex with them. So we're a little bit Neanderthal, and some of us are a little bit Denisovian.
I was trying to correct my record or recollection, and I found
the existence of Neanderthal. They exist about 200,000 years longer than modern humans has been alive. Evidence of their existence vanished about 28,000 years ago, giving us estimates for when they may finally died off. Fossil evidence shows that towards the end, the final two were fringing on survival in the place of Gibraltar.
Gibraltar. Okay, that's near the Baltic Sea.
Okay.
I didn't read in Wikipedia yet, but it says they lived in Eurasia until 40,000 years ago. So until 40,000 years ago, that was true. But how long before that? 800,000 years ago. 800,000 years ago. So you're right, I was wrong. Not 60 million years ago, there was the dinosaurs. 800,000 years ago to kill a 40,000 years ago. Back to you.
Okay, I mean, sources quibble over small factors. What I think most people tend to believe is that the Denisovians and the Neanderthals were one of the first group of pre-Homo sapiens to leave Africa and travel, as you mentioned, to Eurasia, basically Europe and Asia. America wasn't populated by human beings until much, 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 much later. So that's where you find the 2%. In Africa, where most of the other pre-Homo sapiens continue to evolve and cross over with each other, there's far less Neanderthal DNA in their genetic profile. By the way, if you're looking for a location in the world that has the most diverse genetic profile, it's Africa, because a lot of evolving and inbreeding and outbreeding and sidebreeding took place there before little clusters of early man left Africa and traveled up to Asia and Europe and elsewhere.
Okay, so could you repeat your half-life of the DNA?
Okay, you can think in terms of well-preserved DNA. You know, I mean, most stuff just kind of goes bad rather quickly. But if you happen to, die and fall into a tar pit, or there's a bunch of other, more stable and sterile environments that allow for the preservation of organic molecules, then DNA groups have approximately a half-life of 500 years. So if you have, say, a trillion groups of DNA in the strands and such, it'll degrade to half a trillion in 500 years and a quarter of a trillion in the next 500 years and on and on. And you don't just have one molecule of DNA. You have millions and millions of molecules of DNA. So what you end up with is a rather degraded, shredded, large number of samples, if you're lucky, that you can then decode. And you can run through computer algorithms to find similar patterns and then patch them together and kind of build your own genome for Neanderthals. So that's why with 40,000 years of time, you can pretty much figure out what a Neanderthal DNA is, and you're not going to be able to do it for a 60-million-year-old T-Rex, no matter what Jurassic Park says.
If you're looking at the people coming from South America, we see that they have a very specific shape, and usually they are not very tall. When I was reading the literature, scientific literature, about the evolution, there were some areas of the land there, as the continents were drifting, and they are drifting even today, where some human species were isolated. So we may understand also that the diversity of human beings throughout the continents differ because of the genetic code. Am I right, Dr. Roy?
Not quite sure what the question is. I'll ask you to repeat it if I don't answer it the way that I'm going to present things. Again, humanity is not that old. Neanderthals left Africa 400,000 years ago. Our ancestors left Africa later than that. And in a couple of 100,000 years, there hasn't been that severe drift of coastal lines. So it's not a matter, at least for human beings, of having continents shift. It's more ice that formed and offered conduits for travel. And so early humans traveled up from Africa into the Middle East. And then some went east and some went west. Later on, somewhat Asian humans traveled over the North Pole and got to North America, and then slowly went farther south. And then there was a secondary population group that migrated that pushed the what we call South American and Central American types further down into Central and South America, and so North Americans genetically are somewhat different and come from a secondary migration pattern.
Okay. I think you answered the question. But the question was about the human animal as a mammal, and due to mixed genetic code, due to the fact that there were five different human groups. And some of them actually they multiplied, they shared their genetic code, and so I was actually under the impression that the human beings of today, because part of that was in the southern continent. We're talking about the people from like the people from that particular area for thousands of years, and now we have people coming from, let's say, from south of the America or somewhere from Amazon forest. They have a different shape. They have a special, a very characteristic feature. So I was asking if that is because of the isolation from other groups in the world.
Well, I mean, you could say that about everything. There are, early groups of, I wouldn't say, the trouble is if you start to call everyone humans, then you got problems, because as far as I think most anthropologists, humans are Homo sapiens. Even Neanderthal and Denisovans aren't really generally thought of as humans, just hominids. So, you know, different group of early humans arrived at different locations and slowly evolved characteristics that were improved the possibility of them surviving and reproducing. You know, that's Darwin and the rest of those guys. So if you happen to decide to park your place in Scandinavia, there's not a lot of sunlight in Scandinavia. If you continue to have your dark coloration you had in Africa, you'd probably die from vitamin D deficiency. So paler skinned, random mutations were favored, and they lived longer and they reproduced more. And you have all kinds of other factors that favor certain physical and biochemical characteristics. And in isolation, those characteristics become more generalized in that population. If everyone had an airplane and could fly around, most likely there would not be characteristics of a particular country. Everything would be kind of an average, you know, sort of what you see in India in small sample type of thing. But yeah, any civilization that's kind of locked away and doesn't travel much and reproduces within a certain number of miles from center will start to develop similar traits. You can tell the difference. You know, Germans kind of look Germans, Asians look Asian, Central Americans look Central American. It's just because of the lack of the ability for people to travel, you know. Now, life would be different if the airplane was invented 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, I was talking about the Neanderthals, but at the same video, the same scientist said, and then I found that a few times in other publications, we humans, human animals, the mammals, we have 88% of genetic similarity to chimpanzee. So chimpanzee is not bipedal, but there is still 88%. But what he said is chimpanzee just went the different way. They weren't able to evolve, but they were present during the early five. Groups of dead, which now is humanity. Back to you.
If you took Lucy, an old Lucy from 2 million plus years ago, and went into a time machine and went backwards, eventually you would find some ancestor of Lucy's from which the great apes, the chimpanzees and the bonobos all kind of split apart from. So Lucy is not related directly to a chimpanzee, but Lucy's ancestors are related to the ancestors of the chimpanzee.
Could you say a few more words about it, back to you?
okay? The point is, and the problem that people almost always have with evolution is, you know, they say, well, show me a case where a snake turned into a rat. And the problem is that they're not thinking of what evolution actually does. One type of animal doesn't switch off to another animal. What happens is they branch off at an earlier point so that, you know, there was a time that there were no mammals, that, you know, the closest thing to a mammal would be, you know, creatures like the ancestors of the kangaroos and such. So the mammals branched off reptile-like creatures, and things branch off over and over and over again. Sometimes species will kind of reinvent the wheel because of a change in their environment. Water-based animals, for the most part, were not mammalian to begin with. They were able to develop mutations that allowed them to survive and thrive in out of the water, and so you have all the land animals. But occasionally a land animal will decide that his environment is very watery and he would like to efficiently survive in the water. And so you'll have dolphins and whales and such who evolve from ancestors who left the water and entered the land and then went back and had to re-evolve things that work the same way that water-based animals do.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And the last one is, unfortunately, we're talking about the YouTube. YouTube is something great, something wonderful, something that gives us a lot of joy, especially for me, looking for science. And it happened that there was a lady whose parents had a house and they had a garage. And in this garage, two Americans, young Americans, decided to open up YouTube. And then later on, because there was her family, as big as us, company, she became actually co-founder and CEO of that. She was Jewish and Polish, which is close to me, because I'm Jewish and Polish. I'm a Polish Jew. Susan Diana Wojcicki. Of course, I spell it in Polish, Wojcicki, but actually it's Wojcicki. So her grandparents were Jewish, her father was Polish professor in MIT, if I remember properly, in Harvard. And she was born in 1968, so she was a very young woman, and she died. So she was the chief executive officer of the YouTube from 2014 till 2023. Her net worth was estimated at $765 million in 2022. So she wasn't really very much money savvy because the company had a lot of money. She was just trying to make that company working for us. And she died. So that was, so the head of the Google, YouTube, Susan Wojcicki, died. It's, we don't know what's going to happen because it just happened. And who's going to take over? We hope that the YouTube is going to be available in that form. Maybe something bad is going to happen. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, she resigned about a year ago. So she was replaced a while ago. I mean, there was the occasional question of, gee, why did she resign such a nice job? And I guess because of her privacy, it was just stated that she just wanted to spend more time with her family, but it was obviously because she was suffering with lung cancer. But that came and went. The guy has been running YouTube for more than a year now.
She died August 9, 2024. And what it says is Google. Okay, so after observing the success of YouTube, she suggested that Google should buy because she went to work for Google. But of course, YouTube started in her garage. So the deal was approved for $1.645 billion in 2006. She was appointed as the CEO of YouTube in 2014, serving until resigning in February 2023. So it wasn't years ago, it was just last year, February last year. Back to you.
Yeah, I said about a year ago. That's a year and a half ago, so yeah.
Okay. Susan Diane Wojcicki was born in Santa Clara, California, July 5th, 1968. She was daughter of Esther Wojcicki, Jewish and American journalist Stanley Wojcicki, a Polish professor of physics of Stanford University. I know that saying something wrong, so it was Stanford University. Her maternal grandparents were Russian Jewish immigrants. Her parental grandfather, Franciszek Wojcicki, was a Polish politician who was elected as MP during 1947 Polish legislative election. But anyhow, Polish Jew. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. It was a great time. Thank you for giving me time to talk to everybody and to you too. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, thank you, Wes. As always, I appreciate your participation. I appreciate everyone's participation out there. And so we've gotten to 9:35. We do have more time available. If someone has a question or a comment or what have you, just hit that push to talk and tell me who you are.
BB2BXO. How are you, Roy?
I'm doing fine, Frank. How are you?
Doing fine. Next with Sue, WA2JNF, repeater via Zello. I'm wondering if you played with the Zello app at all. Go ahead, Roy.
No, I never did that. There are so many apps out there.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem. Like, everybody has their favorite communications app. And, every time somebody wants to communicate, it's like, go on this app. Like, I'm not familiar with that app. You have to give me a little time to figure it out. Okay, I figured it was worth asking since you seem to be on three or four of the communications apps at the same time when you're on the net. Thanks, it was a try anyway. Excuse me, WB2BX. So.
Yeah, I mean, I keep my eye during the technical net, certainly on IRLP and Echolink and All-Star. Like you said, I mean, probably if you check out every new communications app, you'll probably spend a lot of time installing a lot of things and trying to figure out how to get them to work. So It's usually kind of a neat. If it's a novel new technology, then my love of tech just gets the better of me, my curiosity. But if it's another voice over internet protocol tied to a server, I've seen a lot of them come and a lot of them go. So it has to have some special appeal, some feature that I heard about, or a friend who just demands that I play radio with them on these apps. You've seen a dozen voice over internet protocol apps. You've seen them pretty much all.
Yeah, apparently Zello is an IP radio, TTP radio app. I guess sort of like the old Motorola PTT, direct connect cell phones, walkie-talkie mode cell phones. That's what I make of it. Anyway, Stu apparently has his repeater connected to it, and he said this is how you connect to him, to his repeater, through Zello. So I'm trying to get it, get the connection to work.
Okay, well, you got my curiosity firing. If I hopefully remember, I'll see if it exists as an iOS app, because I don't have Android.
It's definitely an iOS app, because I just installed it. There appear to be two of them, Zello, which is... appears to be Zello Work, which is a paid business app, and Zello Walkie Talkie, which appears to be free. I think the one I installed is Zello Walkie Talkie, and I think that's the one I need. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to figure out. I've got it installed and running. The Echo test, which works similar to the one on Echo Link, works. So I know I have it installed right. But when I put in the server name I was given, the app doesn't seem to find it. And I think it looks like I've done their verification process, so it should be on there. Anyway, that's as far as I've gotten with it so far. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I wish you luck. There's a lot of little possible gotchas that might be involved. It might be a case of port forwarding, if you're using it through your ISP provider. Sometimes they lock particular points for ports for no apparent reason. So I wish you good luck.
Port forwarding problem seems to, for the most part, went away when I switched to FiOS, but I guess that's a possibility. I didn't think of that. I will eventually figure it out. Anyway, did you get on 10 meters today at all?
No, today was my Sunday off hour at N2GOT. He was kind enough to be net control operator. I looked at the PAN adapter. There didn't seem to be a heck of a lot of activity as per usual, so I don't think he got a lot of DX contacts today either. Some people have mentioned that perhaps we will have better luck in August. Well, we're almost halfway through August, and I don't see it yet. But I'll think happy thoughts and see what the future brings us.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are puzzled because Sunspot's numbers are apparently the highest in 23 years, and. A friend of mine on the West Coast told me this afternoon, he said, this sounds like sunspot minimum propagation. To use the word of the week, it's weird.
Yes, yes, that's a well-used term these days. I don't know. It is what it is, unfortunately. I would like it to you know, there's always too much of a good thing. I mentioned before, I'll mention again, there was a ARRLCQ contest when propagation was excellent, and I couldn't find a single kilocycle to call my own. I just gave up. So I would like something in the middle if I could order propagation conditions. But it's been abysmal for months now, and I assume it'll change because the nature of the universe has changed, but I don't know how long it's going to take for it to change now.
Yeah, but I've heard the same predictions you are, that it's supposed to change in August. Some of the solar storms were supposed to go away, and we were supposed to get something resembling sunspot peak propagation. I agree with you. I have yet to see it, and a buddy of mine on the West Coast said the same thing today. He has not seen it. A lot of us are trying to work the Jarvis Island N5J the expedition, and they're running low power to verticals and very difficult to hear. I did get my one contact with them on 17 meter CW, and I got confirmation that I'm in the log. So I've done better than some people. I got my one contact. But like you said, kind of like to see, kind of disappointing that we're not seeing super propagation on 10 and 6 meters. Anyway, back to you to move on to the next person. WB2BXO.
AC2GS. Well, last year we had a similar situation, and I think it finally broke in September, so I was never terribly optimistic about the August predictions, but I hold a little bit of optimism for September, changing propagations. We'll see what happens. Not like we can do anything. You can't complain to the manufacturer, so we'll just have to deal with what the universe hands us. So 783, Frank, and as always, I appreciate these opportunities for your participation and to have a conversation with you, and I hope to talk to you, down the line next Sunday, likewise.
Okay, as far as I know, I'll be around next Sunday. I'll probably be on a bit later for the space report. 73 for now, WB2BX.
Okie dokie. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limemark Technical Net. We still got a little bit more time if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion. If something popped into your head and you'd like to share it with us, or something that I talked about earlier tonight left you with more questions than answers, then feel free to hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
WB2 America Sam Good.
Yes, what's your first name, sir?
Hi, Chet. I'm just wondering, regards to MFJ, the only thing I want to buy, or I did want to buy, months ago, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 months ago, I was looking at the fiberglass telescoping pipes. MASTS, and then he went out of business. Does anybody have any idea as to what they're doing in getting rid of the merchandise that they have? I sure would like to find out about those masks that they advertise, if they have any. And who do you go to, them, MFJ, or... Are they still answering emails, or did somebody buy all the the merchandise, like maybe DX Engineering or somebody bought everything up. Does anybody have latest news on MFJ? If you do, could you come on the frequency and let us know about what's going on with MFJ and this edition, I don't know if that's the way to describe it, of the material that they had in stock.
Yeah, thanks, Chet. It was my understanding that they didn't just go out of business. They simply stopped manufacturing. So they were going to make their inventory available through retailers and through direct until they really ran low, and then they would kind of fold things. And they would, but the way I heard it, that they would still maintain some degree of a presence. They would be available for spare parts, available for repairs. My suggestion, and I'll ask the audience if they know anything more recent than I, look them up. I'm sure the website is still active. Give them a call. I talked to the guys there. They're friendly, and they'll tell you if they have it in inventory or if not, if any third party might have that item in inventory. But if anyone has any better, more up-to-date information, feel free to share.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm not sure about MFJ, what their status is. I believe their history, of course. The telescopic mass that he's speaking of, if you're only going to go up about 20 feet or so, let's say a light vertical, 2 meters or something that's not you're not going to put a rotator on top or anything, but something on a real light side. Harbor Freight makes one. It goes up about 20 feet. And they go for around, I think, $70 or more than that. You can send away for them. They actually used to have them in the store. I know somebody that bought one that they were having. But, they're really meant for flagpoles, but, what's a ham going to do with a flagpole? Anyway, back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, that's good advice. By the way, MFJ still has a website up. So you can kind of do a search, and probably best to get the phone number and call them up and ask them, because it's not the friendliest website I've ever seen. But they seem to be still selling stuff.
Okay, thank you, Roy. I hope I feel like a 40-foot pole to replace my 30-foot aluminum pole. And the problem with that is that I got it up, but very difficult to get it down, getting older and older, and except, drop it on the yard, and a telescoping version, something very strong to hold up one end of my HF antenna, would be beautiful. You can lower it, the telescoping type pole, you can just lower it 6 feet at a time or something like that, whatever it is, 5 feet at a time, with those locking mechanisms that they have, and I can lower the top of my pole to do some maintenance here and there. But the way it is now, I worry every time a storm comes, am I going to have any trouble with the wire that's going over there? I have a pulley up there, but I always look at it and say, oh, geez, it's still holding up on that end there. Someday I want to replace it with a thicker piece, thicker diameter, and be able to go up and down and do my maintenance in the future as I hopefully get even older, more aged. Better think of those things. When I was young, no big thing. I would manhandle the thing down and manhandle it back up, but getting to that point now where I can't do that.
AC2GS, I understand entirely, Chet. The MFJ site has two pages of of collapsible fiberglass poles. So I think you'll be able to find what you're looking for there.
Yeah, I was hoping that somebody was auctioning them off and get them at a lower price. But so they are available, and I'll look at that again, and I'll get them a call and see what the pricing is on that and replace that aluminum pipe that I have sticking up right now. All right, guys, very good. A very interesting tech net. It's talking about Neanderthals and dinosaurs and all that. And you're very knowledgeable, right, on every subject. Boy, oh boy, Einstein had nothing on you. WDKHK.
Thank you very much, Chet. But, Einstein had a lot more than I have. I have book learning, you know. I mean, I didn't make up any of this stuff that I tell you guys. At least I hope I didn't. I don't mean to. I just a very curious guy. Like I've told people before, I got this lovely little picture of good old Albert on the wall of my shack, and I got the line, "I have no special talents, I am only passionately curious." And so am I. And thankfully we live in a time and a place where you can get almost any question answered, and I love to share it with everyone out there. So thank you, Chet. And again, the MFJ site gives you prices as well, and a little button that says buy now. So you can pretty much, if you want to call and chat with the guy, I'm sure they'll chat with you. But otherwise, you can just look up MFJ site and go to the little magnifying glass and type in, fiberglass poles, and you'll get 2 pages worth of products. Okie-dokie, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limemark Technical Net, and we're still open for business. And as Chet mentioned, I tend to read a lot about a lot of things, so I hopefully can help with any kind of science and or technical questions that you might have tonight. And, you know, I might learn something, you might learn something, or at least we'll all be entertained. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free, hit that push to talk, and give me your first name and your call sign.
John, V3ITR, Freeman, sir.
Hello, what can I do you for?
Is there such a thing as an SDR software that has HF on an AS radio, remote controlled, and free? Is there an app like that?
Well, it sort of depends on the factors that you're interested in. The closest that I could offer you as a suggestion is that there's a whole bunch of these things called web SDRs, which are basically guys who, either out of the kindness of their heart or just to show their technical prowess, have put up multiple SDR stations that are accessible by websites. So you can and you can use websites on a cell phone, on a pad, on a PC, on a laptop, what have you, and the price is free. You are limited to the people offering the service and limited to the band that they're configured to operate on. Most of them are one-way. When you start to talk about two-way operation, there's a few out there that are free, but again, the problem is that everyone else knows about them as well. I used to use it was a guy, I think he was in Minnesota, and he offered his HF radio input, output, transmit, receive through EchoLink. Problem is he offered it through to everyone. So I would tune in to an interesting frequency, and inevitably some guy who's really interested in listening to East Cars would change the frequency, and I would have to listen to a bunch of people throw out their IDs and little else. So, you know, you get what you pay for or what you don't pay for. But it sounds like you might find WebSDRs useful. Just Google it, and there's a plethora of them around all over the world.
No, I have WebSDR, but I haven't come across any of their 2-1 their receivers. I've got one SDR that 120 and it is in 40 meters, but it's just receive only.
Yeah, that's a big problem. People are much more generous with just listening into reception as opposed to operating their transmitter. So, as I said, they're very few and far between. I don't know if that station on Echolink is still around. I was kind of thrown off of it because the guy's pastor didn't like what amateur radio frequencies I was listening to and gave him a hard time. But there were about two or three. If you contact Handyham, if you look it up, they used to have at least a few remotely operational through Echolink radios where you could do receive and transmit. So there's a few of them, not many. There's a couple of companies that have monetized that process, but that's not free. So there's a lot of places to listen, but not a heck of a lot of free places to transmit.
WB2BX with some comments.
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, okay. There's remotehams.com, which you can get on quite a few guys' stations, and I think most of them don't charge. You need to just upload a copy of your license. And you're right about SDR.org. You can find it on, as you said, on through Google or your favorite, any other favorite search engine. And the technical issue is that with the SDRs, multiple people can use them at the same time. Multiple people can't use a transceiver, can't transmit at the same time. So it's a much scarcer resource. You can find them for free, as you said, online. And, I think the one you use through Echolink, which I think that's run by Handyhams, I'm sort of familiar with that one. I really haven't tried to use them. And the remote transceivers I use are as a service I pay for. It's a scarce resource, and as you said, the one I use has all kinds of bells and whistles. It's really cool, but it's a really cool price also. but to get it on for a couple of minutes a day and watch the X, it's fine. Considering that they use top of the line radios like your Flex radio, it's understandable why it's the top of the line price also. Anyway, that's my two bits on remote radio. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for your time there. Sharing it much. We'll definitely do it again. I won't live radio, then was all simulated, so you weren't actually on a radio. Otherwise, we'll get up. Have a good evening, Victor Echo 3, the Queen Radio.
AC2GS. Well, John, good luck. You're kind of a rarity, although we do have an IRLP connection with Barrie, Ontario, Canada, repeater. It was very infrequently we talk to Canada. I see that you're coming through Echolink. So I wish you lots of luck. Try out that remote ham that Frank mentioned. I haven't used them because they probably popped up after I could operate by myself. But, yeah.